Welcome to Series 3 of the Social Care Podcast, Sharing Stories, with me, David Bagnall, also known as Baggy, and Audrey Moore.
We are delighted to be back with the third series, sharing stories from interesting people in the social care world for the benefit of those working in and studying social care.
In this series, we will be chatting to a number of interesting guests on a range of diverse topics, such as the changing face of social care as a result of regulation, supporting people with intellectual disabilities as they age, working in the homeless services, how to manage exam stress as a student, and much more.
We'll also be collaborating with Social Care Ireland at their annual conference and chatting with the keynote speakers. You might know this already, but we're huge advocates of networking within social care, and without it, we wouldn't have been able to meet so many amazing people to interview here. We'd encourage everyone to embrace any opportunities they get to meet and chat with more people in the sector. Our guest this week is Claire O'Sullivan. Claire's worked for many years with those experiencing homelessness, men, women and families. Since joining Tintawn 7 years ago, she's been passionate about the experiences of mothers in particular and the invisibility they feel when they're separated from their children. Claire wishes to give women a voice, to help them to feel visible in the world and their community, to reduce the shame and stigma they feel, and to also create a system in homeless services where workers can talk about issues such as this, where they're skilled in supporting women to see their children where at all possible, and access services appropriately, empowering them to self-advocate for their rights. Claire, you're very welcome to the Social Care Podcast.
Very welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So Claire, maybe we'll start, if you could tell us a little bit about how you got into this line of work or how you got into social care in general.
Yeah, I suppose might be a little bit different to some people, but for a lot of women, I think it will resonate with them. I didn't go to college straight from school. I actually went straight out into the workforce and tried lots of different things. I then went on to get married and I had 2 children. And it was, I suppose, really a lot of it was as I was becoming older, I was in my late 20s, I was starting to look at what I wanted to do. In my childhood and in my adolescence, we experienced active addiction within my own family. So my brother actually was in active addiction for as long as I can remember, really. He's 3.5 years younger than me. So he would have started his addiction maybe when he was about 15. And that really did impact our family greatly. And it was when I was in my 20s and had my own children that I realized that a lot of my time was spent researching the whole area of addiction and recovery and so on. And also, I suppose I became very aware of different roles that maybe I was taking on within the family also, as we all do, even where you're the child, where you can, you know, maybe adopt a more parental, maternal role also and a helper role. So then I decided I'd go to college. So I actually went to college to the Addiction Training Institute at the time to study to become what I thought I was going to be initially, an addiction counsellor. That's how I started.
Was there something in the training itself that made you feel like this is the way you wanted to go, as well as your own experience?
Yeah, it was very interesting, actually, because it was a mix of the personal experience that had led me there and the training itself and the lecturers. So it was Applied Addiction Studies was the name of the course. It was in All Hallows College, which was fabulous. It's a beautiful venue as well. An environment is so important, isn't it?
Yeah.
And one of the lecturers in particular, I would say, inspired me to become the harm reductionist that I would say that I am now and the activist that I am now. And his name is Gary Broderick, and he is an unbelievable harm reductionist. And part of his modules really resonated with me. And at the time, I lived in Kerry. I'm from Kerry originally. So I would travel up every week for a couple of days to Dublin on the train. And I'd be leaving maybe a very difficult situation at home, not knowing where my brother was, maybe not knowing was he going to be okay, and carrying that, and also carrying the fact that I was a mommy and I had 2 small little boys at home and juggling childcare and all of the different things we do as mothers. So I'd have all of that in my head, and I'd come into college and I just was eating, sleeping and breathing this whole area of addiction and recovery. And I remember one day I met with Gary Broderick after college, and I just said to him, look, can I talk to you? Can I just touch base with you on something that's going on for me? I just really want, you know, your expert opinion on it. And at the time, my brother was in a really, really bad place. And as a family, we were falling apart. We were really falling apart at the seams, the whole lot of us. And I just said to him, I said, at this stage, we don't know what to do. I said, we're reaching out. My family are reaching out to different organizations for help. And we're kind of getting varying ideas. A lot of the time, what we're hearing is you need to let him hit rock bottom. You need to pull away. You need to. And I said, that seems to be going against everything as a human being and as a family that we believe we should be doing, because we just want to keep him alive. We don't know what else we're doing at this stage, but we want to keep him alive. And I did say to him, and his face, I remember the shock when I said this to him. I said, we're constantly waiting for the knock on the door from the guards to say he's gone. And I actually said to him, sometimes I wonder, would that be easier? Because we'd actually have closure, because there's actually so much pain. And he said to me, and I'll always remember it, he said, don't you ever say anything like that again. Because he said, where there's life, there's hope. And he said to me, he said, if your brother right now was in a car accident, he said, and he's knocked down on the side of the road, what does he need? And it took me a while to get it. And then I said, well, he'd need an ambulance. And he said, yeah. And then what? I said, well, he'd go to A&E and he'd need emergency care. And he said, that's it. So he said, right now, your brother needs emergency care. So he said, there is nothing wrong with your family just keeping him alive at this stage. And it might sound really simple, but that lit a fire within me to start trusting my gut more and to start trusting my human instinct more and to realize, okay, that if I can have the personal conviction and my gut telling me, let's just keep somebody alive for now. And let's try to reduce the harm where we can. And it kind of gave us permission to do that. I remember going home on the train and ringing my mom and kind of saying, yeah, somebody said it's okay. And this is a professional. And he said, it's okay that we're doing this. We're not wrong that we're bringing him dinners and we're trying to get him to eat food. And that even though there might be very little more we can do at this point, we're doing this. And fast forward years down the line, and my brother, we've gone, I suppose, ups and downs and ups and downs. He's married, he has two kids, he has his own business, and he has come out of all of that. And I know harm reduction helped with that. So I would absolutely say that one of my lecturers and my training had such an impact.
That's so powerful. And I'm sure there's plenty of people listening to this who are looking for that grain of hope. And just hearing that is so, so powerful. Thank you, Claire.
Yeah, what that gave to us was the permission. Mm. You know, because we'd go to different meetings and, you know, we'd start talking. Me and my mom used to go and they'd come to us and we'd say, so I need to tell you what's going on with him. And they'd say, no, 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 you need to care about yourself. Now, I understand that's hugely important. Of course I do. And there does need to be that self-care, and families really struggle with this and they do need that. But you know what? We needed a space for us to be able to say, no, no, I need to talk to you about the pain he's going through, because we adore him. Mm. And we knew he was hurting himself more than he was hurting anybody else. But the love never went. So we needed a space to hear that.
From listening to you speak, it reminds me a lot in college and conversations I had, and even into the workplace now. Sometimes you know in your gut, in your head, whatever, that something is right. You know what it is and you know what you need to do, but you don't have a name for it. And when you go into education or you go to a group or you speak to someone directly like you did, they give it a name, and that gives it more of a power, or it makes it a tool for you to use properly. You know, it's not just something that I think might be right. Somebody is validating that what I'm doing is right. Like, I think the one big thing I learned from college was about learned helplessness. I knew as a father growing up, that kids go through that, you know, just for me, without work or whatever. And then when we went to the social care work and you see it all going, then when I got a name for it in psychology, and I said, yeah, it makes perfect sense. All these wonderful people out there giving us the names for the tools. But it sounds like you got a lot from directions.
You're so right, because I actually think when I wanted to go into the whole area of addiction recovery, right? I mean, it's kind of obvious why I wanted to go into it, obviously. But I had no clue what I wanted. What I did know was that everywhere we tried to reach out to for help for my brother, and everywhere he tried to reach out for, there was obstacles put in his way, it seemed. So it was a case of, we might ring a treatment center and we'd be told, oh, he needs to ring himself. And I'd be like going, no, like he's nearly dead. He's not able to do that. So I'm doing it on his behalf. Like if he had cancer, now I understand GDPR, nobody will talk to anybody about. But that was really, really difficult. Whereas you're absolutely right in what you said about the tools to put into my toolkit, because I learned about harm reduction the first time when I went to college. And I thought, wow, the dignity in this.
Yeah.
The understanding even around the history of substance use, the learning that I had around recognizing that through the entirety of mankind and womankind, people have always sought to alter their states of consciousness. Always. This is not new. This isn't new to any of us. So the judgment and the stigma and all of the prohibition and everything else around it is one thing. But if mankind and womankind have always sought to alter the state of consciousness, well, then there has to be more than, in my opinion, the Minnesota model. There has to be more than, you know, abstinence. There has to be choice. There has to be reducing harm. And yeah, I learned those tools and they have stood to me through my entire career in social care.
I find that there is an awful lot of stigma out there in relation to addicts and, you know, the language that's used in the media, especially. It's very judgmental about addiction and people who are in recovery. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely spot on. I think there's huge judgment and stigma. And I think it's very interesting because when we look at the impact that alcohol has on people's lives and the impact that alcohol has in the deaths that occur in Ireland, in the violence that occurs within homes, it's so much more than other substances. You know, a lot of people feel, well, drugs is something that's not going to happen to me. That happens to other people. You know, that's not me. That's not my family. And I know from my own experience within my own family, realizing like my parents, I remember when I was really small, we grew up in a council estate and my parents were able to buy their council house and move to the countryside. And they did that for one reason, because they said, before our children are teenagers, we want to get them out of the estate. We want to be more careful around who they're associating with and so on. So I would say that they did so much to try and protect us. My brother still ended up with substance use issues. So, you know, it's a case of, I recognize that it actually can happen everywhere. And addiction occurs, I suppose I'd see it as on a continuum. So for me, there's no judgment and no stigma, because I'd say to any of the women who I work with now, who might be in varying degrees of substance use or early recovery or whatever, that it's actually not about the substance. It's about the behaviors from the substance. And it's about the impact that it's having on your life and whether you can actually live your life in a productive manner according to you. Just because my standards might say, oh, I don't think that's okay. Well, that's me in my life. You know, each individual is their own person. I'd view addiction as occurring along a continuum. So while I might have somebody on one end of it who has taken the pledge and who has never drank even alcohol, let's say, and then a little bit further along the continuum, I have somebody who might just, you know, experiment a little bit. A little bit further on, I have somebody who might get involved with some binge drinking. A little bit further along, there might be a dependence building up, but we're still not in full-blown addiction here, because obviously addiction is something that's really progressive. And then on this level, right at the other end, I may have somebody in full-blown dependency. So then I suppose our responses with policy and practice need to be able to respond to people at the different levels on the continuum. And that's the beauty of where harm reduction comes in. Because where addiction and recovery for workers in social care can be frustrating, because it might look as though there's very little progress, very little movement, it all depends on how you measure success, because there's always something we can do, because there's always strategies we can utilize with somebody to just reduce the harm. And once we help to keep people alive, well, then there's always something we can do. There's hope.
And for anyone who's listening who doesn't understand what harm reduction is, do you want to maybe run through what are the principles of it?
Yeah, I suppose there's lots of varying principles with harm reduction. One of the main ones is that people have choice and people have control, and that's a huge element of it. And the reality is that people choose to use a substance to alter their state of consciousness or escape reality or make them even just feel normal. So that's one of the main ones, that there is choice and that there is control. Other ones, I suppose, are around first, do no harm. So it's around us reducing harm at all times, looking to reduce harm, so that regardless of what a person is doing. So, you know, we may, in my line of work, if we have women who are injecting heroin users, then we might straight away start to look at their injecting practices and start to look at, well, where are you injecting? Because groin injecting is a lot more dangerous, let's say, than injecting in the arm. So it might be looking at that. And then it might be reducing the harm to move away from injecting towards smoking. Then it might be harm reduction is also maybe somebody might want to start Suboxone or methadone treatment programs. If somebody is drinking, it may be that spirits are actually really affecting this woman's health. And it also may be that spirits are actually causing a lot of behavior issues, which is making it very difficult for her to access homeless accommodation, because maybe there's aggression, maybe there's violence. So we'll look at harm reduction strategies and look at the fact of, well, what would it be like if you stayed away from spirits? You know, if you're looking at drinking some beer instead. So therefore, you're reducing the levels of alcohol, but you're also possibly reducing the behaviors that might prohibit somebody from accessing homeless accommodation or getting evicted. Because then you're able to look at, okay, now we might be able to put a more stable roof over somebody's head while they're in the hostel accommodation. And at least when, again, we know this and research supports this, that when somebody doesn't have a roof over their head, well, the chance of stability and the chance of stabilizing is a lot less.
Something that strikes me about working with people with addiction, and I've never worked in that area, so speaking as an outsider, is I work in disabilities and I work with a lot of young people who have autism. And everybody Yes. accepts that people who have autism are very different, very separate, have very different needs and need specific ways of working with them. But very often when I've heard people speaking about people in addiction, it seems to be that there's, well, just one way of treating them will treat the whole lot of them. It's not a very individualized sector. It's kind of like, well, if we open this place and we put that in there, that'll suit everybody.
Yes.
Is there any truth in that? Or
I think, in fairness, I suppose Ireland has become more progressive in terms of harm reduction and in terms of having maybe a menu of options for people to avail of, again, which goes along with our whole choice, that people need a menu of options. So we're definitely better in that way. But I suppose our treatment centres very often can be founded on the abstinence model. And very often, I suppose, in order to avail of a treatment centre, a person may need to actually come off of benzodiazepines, may need to come off of their methadone or reduce down drastically on their methadone. So it's one of the things that always kind of struck me as a bit odd to say, okay, if I need to come into this center for help, I need to stop using the substances that I'm using right now, but I'm wanting to come in to the center to stop using them. But apparently I've stopped using them before I come in. Never kind of made sense to me. And it is a difficult one, which is why I suppose in the service that I'm part of now and that I run, a big part of it is we're a harm reduction service with a recovery. We're recovery oriented, absolutely. But it's about what the person's recovery looks like. So it's about what is that recovery mean for you? What does it mean? So when people say recovery, even like when I get, say, some of the social care workers, the project workers that work with me, they might have a support plan and, you know, it may be, oh, she wants to achieve recovery. And I'll always go back and kind of give a little bit of feedback there and go, what does that mean, though? When she says she wants recovery, what does that look like for her? And actually, it reminds me of one of my favorite harm reduction sentences. And I'm probably not going to get this right now, by a fella by the name of John Strang. And he talks about a policy of harm reduction. And he says how it's about recognizing with harm reduction that it might be better to go for a probable silver rather than a possible gold. And I liked that. I thought, oh, I really like that. Because now what we have, you know, we talk about smart goals, don't we, when we're talking about support planning and so on. So now we're talking about, if I'm going to instill hope in somebody, and that's a huge thing to try and do that for somebody and hold that hope for somebody. Well, if I can say to them, there's a probable silver here, that's a lot more tangible and a lot more meaningful. You can achieve that. There's a chance you can achieve that. Who knows? They might then, I mean, harm reduction does not say that abstinence is not desired. If that's what somebody wants in their recovery, absolutely it is. But in harm reduction, you're always achieving something.
I visited a wet hostel once, well, for a couple of days on the trot, and I spoke with some people who were working there. I was visiting somebody that I knew that was staying there. And I found that the people were very positive in the fact that, like, I know what I am and I know what I want to be. And it's taken me a long time to get there. But they were able to, they weren't the exact words that they were using, but that was kind of what they were saying. I know what I am and I know what I want to be. And I found that the people that were working there were really supportive and going, yeah, we know what you can be too, if you want to get there. Like you say, I think, yeah, the reduction seems to be the way to go. For me, that would be the way to go.
Yeah, one of my first placements actually was in a wet hostel with Novus in Kerry, and it was fantastic. It was talk about in at the deep end on my first placement into the wet hostel, and it was a mixed wet hostel, so it was men and women. And I remember my mom saying to me, I can't believe you're doing this. You're always really scared of people who are drunk. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, if this is the line of work I'm going to go into, I need to kind of get over that, don't I? But I learned so much in the wet hostel. And I then went and did further placements within treatment centres and within their transitional house, which was a dry house. And I learned so much in there. One of the main things that I learned in there is, you know, even though I had thought I wanted to be an addiction counsellor, and I did go in and I started my training as an addiction counsellor, and I practiced as an addiction counsellor for almost 3 years. But I realized very quickly, actually, that my heart and my passion lay within homeless services. And it lay within, you know, the people that I had met within homeless services and the absolute survival that was in these people and these wonderful human beings that I was meeting all of the time, who I was aware there was so much stigma and so much judgment and they were looked down upon. But I realized, and it all comes back to relationship, and we know in social care, relationship and that therapeutic alliance is key, isn't it? But by making these relationships and making these connections and realizing that you have the opportunity to try and make somebody's day a little bit better, that's massive. That's huge. And that gave more to me, I have to say, than my work in addiction counseling. So I left addiction counseling and I went full time into homeless services.
So it's clear, Claire, that you are so passionate about the work that you do. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your journey and where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose that took me through from when my boys were small and college and work and so on. And then I went through some really, really difficult times myself. When my boys were 7 and 9, my husband actually was diagnosed with cancer and he died 6 months afterwards. And it was just, I have to say, it was very, very interesting because I had taken some time out of work, obviously, when he was very unwell. And none of us expected that he would, you know, that he would die. That was never part of the plan. And I'm a great one for plans. And, I can do anything once I have a plan. So my biggest thing after he died was that wasn't the plan. This wasn't the plan. What do I do now? And the boys were only 7 and 9. So it was absolute chaos. And I don't remember an awful lot of the first 6 months, I'd say, after he died. But eventually I realized, again, it's interesting. One of the modules in my addiction studies and in my training came back to me because I remembered that when you look at statistics and you look at one of the biggest risk factors for children, and my being a mommy is just huge to me. And one of the biggest risk factors for children in developing a substance use disorder would be the loss of a parent. And I remember remembering that after my husband died. And I remember the feeling of panic of, this is something I can't control and how can I control it? But then I very quickly remembered that the number one protective factor is having one good parent. And I thought to myself, I can be that. I can be that one good parent. I can't control what happened. I couldn't control what happened, but I can control how I move forward. And I realized, right, that's what I need to do. So I went back to work and focused on my work and being a mommy and juggling all of that and now being a single mother. And then fast forward a few years later, and I realized I'm only in my 30s and I'm going to be on my own for the rest of my life. And I realized I didn't want to be. A friend of mine actually put me online, and I was way before Tinder and all of these things because I'm nearly 49 now. So we're going back a good few years. So it was on Plenty of Fish, and I met a man from County Waterford, from Waterford City. And we just fell hook, line and sinker in love. He had two kids. I have two kids. So we're now a blended family living in Waterford City.
Wow.
So that was my journey of what brought me from Kerry, because not many people leave the kingdom. But that's what brought me. It was a man. And at the time when we were considering, would he move to Kerry or would I move to Waterford? One of the things I had learned about in college, again, it's amazing how much it comes back to it. And I don't think about it too much, but I really am today, was I was learning about housing first as a way of working with people who are experiencing homelessness. And again, it wasn't in Ireland at the time at all. Like it wasn't here, because that was years ago. It was Canada. It was New York. And I was like, that's amazing. Like, this is, wow, the dignity again and the humanity. And then I was on ActiveLink one day and there was an ad for a pilot project for Housing First in Waterford City. And I just thought, oh my God, that's got me written all over it. So Southeast Simon Community were recruiting. And I had been with Novus for a number of years at this stage. So I applied and I got the job in the Housing First pilot project in Waterford and moved up, me and my boys.
That's some journey you've been on, Claire.
Yeah. And I couldn't believe it. And I remember I was thinking, even doing the research for that interview, like I knew what I could bring to the interview because I believed in it. You know, I kind of thought, sure, this makes sense. I don't understand how we're not all doing this. Why is this not the general approach? And I walked in and I, you know, the way you still imposter syndrome, don't you know, we all get that. And I couldn't believe when I get the call to say that I was successful and I got the job. And boy, was that another cutting my teeth, trying to do Housing First in a pilot project with private rental. So that was the pilot project of it.
And what year was that?
2013. So
not that long ago.
No, it wasn't that long ago. But at the time, it wasn't about, say, the AHBs, the approved housing bodies, or the local authorities giving properties. That's what they were doing in Dublin. But in Waterford, it was a pilot to say, well, let's see, can we do this within the private rental market? Because, of course, that does happen in other countries, but that's because they have a lot of other wraparounds supporting it. So I did that for 3 years. It was very, very challenging, but I had amazing times in it and met some amazing people as well from all disciplines. And one of the main things that I learned, I suppose, from that, I mean, you learn it in homeless services, but I really learned it in Housing First, was how we can't be all things to all people. And that actually it's really important to have the multidisciplinary team around an individual to provide the different supports. And that's what I brought with me into my role that I'm in since 2016 now in Tintawn Housing, which is we provide homeless accommodation for women with complex needs. So be that active addiction, really poor mental health, maybe not compliant with mental health medication or appointments or so on. And we provide long-term housing for women and also for families. But recognizing that care and case management as a framework and really providing that wraparound to the person is what's needed. And that's wonderful, I think, for people to get, that we don't need to know everything. We need to have a really good working knowledge of lots of different things in social care. We do, because it's so varied. But I don't have to be an expert in everything. I just have to be an expert in my part and then surround myself with the right people, the right professionals.
And sometimes it's just being you. It's not necessarily what you know or what you can do. It's just being you and you're the right person to hook that person to do what they need to do.
That's so true. And that comes back to the relationship again, doesn't it? And I suppose our skills in being ourselves and recognizing that it's okay to be open and to be transparent and that it's okay to kind of say, God, that's really affected me, what you've said to me there. I really feel for you. And or to even to be able to say to somebody, you're really going through a shit time at the moment. That's really hard. And just have that humanity. Yeah.
But like we were saying before we started the interview in our little chat, social care is such a broad and it caters for so many different aspects of life in general. And
yes,
we all have a little bit of knowledge about lots of things.
Yeah.
And all of us coming together, even like this sharing stories and what you do, someone say, I didn't know we could do that in social care.
Yeah.
Because a lot of things sound like they're very specialized. And it's a branch of what we do. Everything is a branch of social care and what we do. And it's finding that right branch for you. And maybe you might inspire a few people who are listening to this to say, that's something that I'd really be interested in doing. I think it's great.
I think you're right, because it's like I always say to people, and I mean, I suppose maybe different professions and different strands, different branches of social care might attract different people with different personalities and different skill sets. One of the things I love about homeless services, it ignites me all the time because you're always learning. There is always something more to learn. The learning is never finished. Every day is a school day, and that sounds really glib, but it's so true. So like in homeless services, we need to have so much knowledge around housing. So, you know, running an approved housing body now, so working my way up, and I'm now manager of the service. There's so much around the regulation with ABRA, with all of the regulatory, the charities regulatory authority. There's so much we need to know, even, you know, with, you know, attending board meetings, reporting to the board, all of that. But then there's also the other side of it is supporting the team to provide these frontline amazing interventions with human beings. And it's responding to people in times of crisis, in times of celebration, and, you know, different things that's going on for them, whether it's around my children are gone, how do I get to see my children? Or I've been 2 years and I haven't seen my children. And for somebody within homeless services, within our profession, to be able to say, oh, hold on a minute now, there's life, there's hope. There's always something you can do. And would you like us to help you to start make those connections? So we're going to empower you to do it. But at times where you need your hand to be held to actually get there, well, then we're going to do that for you. Absolutely. Because we all need help sometimes. And that's just wonderful. So, yeah, it's constantly evolving. And it's a wonderful area to be in.
Absolutely. And even the majority of my work in social care has been disability services. But I agree with you. No 2 days are the same. Yeah. The variety in the work, I mean, you could be taking on a multitude of roles in any one day.
Yeah.
But I always enjoyed that. I really do. This podcast is sponsored by Trust Social Care Consultancy for the support and development of social care workers. Find out more about how we can support you or your team by visiting trustconsultancy.ie. The link is also in the show notes. Now, back to the podcast. So for the people who are working, say, as social care workers with the clients that come into Tintawn, what would they be doing kind of on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, that's a great question. Our main service, where our offices are based in the middle of Waterford City, we have a 12-apartment block, and 10 of those apartments are independent apartments. And 2 of the apartments are offices. That's always the way it is, isn't it? It's like not fit for purpose, but we make the best of it. So the women come into us, they're referred into us through a variety of different ways, through probation services, through mental health services, through the local authority, whatever. And so they're living in their apartments. So I don't want to sound patronizing by saying we're teaching people life skills, because actually I think that is patronizing, because so many people have these life skills, but maybe they've just... they're not maybe have been acquainted with them for a while because of different things that have happened in their lives. So it might be having a key work session with your allocated key client. Service users is the term that we use, or residents. So you'd have a key work session. Sometimes they would use Outcome Star as one of the tools to use for their key work sessions. And it's really around getting to know the person, building the relationship. One of the documents that we use when somebody comes into us straight away is our initial and comprehensive assessment that is used widely amongst homeless services and the addiction services. It's a combined document under care and case management. And in that assessment, we're assessing somebody's physical health, mental health, substance use, their family composition, offending behavior. There's, you know, the whole gamut, the whole thing, really, the whole wheel. And from that, it's developing a support plan. So it's referring people to the appropriate organizations, organizing for them to attend these meetings, advocating for them where they can't attend these meetings because maybe somebody's going through withdrawals, maybe somebody's in physical pain, and we don't believe in making people suffer. That's not what it's about. So we'd be really strong believers in Tintawn of saying, so, you know, I'm aware that Claire had an appointment with you at 9 o'clock in the morning at probation services, but actually that's not realistic. So we're going to ask you to change that to 12 p.m. And we're going to ask you, would you come into Tintawn and would you meet her within her own home, at least for the first few appointments? Because I think that's part of what needs to change in Ireland. It's changing, but not completely, where it's like, oh, people need to prove that they're ready for change. And I suppose where we understand around motivation is that this whole idea of readiness for change, it's something that comes in waves, isn't it? And it dips and it ebbs and it flows. So it's around catching people and meeting them where they're at. And again, we might all use these terms, meeting them where they're at, but I think it's around reflecting on it and kind of going, what does that actually mean? Why am I asking the person to come to me at 10 o'clock in the morning when I know that that's really difficult for them, or that they have to get, you know, we're Waterford City, but we're not Dublin City. So the bus services are not the same. Services can be spread out geographically. So for somebody to actually get there, that might be really difficult for them. So a lot of advocacy work is what somebody might be doing. Then it might be about helping them to complete some paperwork so that we might need to update their housing needs assessment with the local authority. Maybe they have been assessed that they have a one-bed housing need, but now they're going to be able to have some access with their children. I hate that word access because it's their children, but that they might be able to see their children. They might be moving towards having the children on overnights. So therefore, we're going to be advocating to the local authority that their housing need is assessed to a two-bed, so that when we're looking at the move-on plan, whether it's through private rental or, you know, long-term accommodation with an approved housing body or the local authority, at least they have an extra space for a child. Then it may be accompaniment to court. So if there's a court case coming up, if there's, for a lot of our women, I would say the vast majority, there's always experiences of violence in their past. And more often than not, there'll still be experiences of violences within their present relationships. So we do a lot of work around domestic violence, around liaising with our local women's refuge and the local domestic violence outreach workers. But again, that comes back to social care and how we have to know lots of things, because we have to have an understanding of safety orders, barring orders, protection orders, and so on. So yeah, really varied.
So it's very varied and complex work then, but a really interesting area for people to work in who have done social care. And you can see how the skills that you would pick up in social care will be very relevant there, like especially the relationship building, the advocacy work, social policy, not being aware of court orders and stuff like that. Yeah, wow.
100%. And I think what it highlights to me as well, because obviously when you're working with people in active addiction, there's also the situation where, so like in Tintawn, as part of our harm reduction ethos, we also do provide, you know, safer injecting equipment. So people might come in looking to have some, take some needles or take whatever they need. And we'd always say, let every interaction be an intervention. Every interaction can be an intervention. So we're never just having a cup of tea. You know, we're assessing. The cup of tea is hugely important, but we're assessing. We're checking in. We're kind of, you know, we're watching to see, does she seem a little bit low? Does she seem more low than normal? We're thinking, okay, she's asked me for some works here, but I'm aware she hasn't used in some time and she's just come out of hospital after a 2-week stay. So now I'm concerned that her tolerance has dropped. So the risk of overdose is higher. So there's always something that we're doing with that. But what comes with that as well is the fact that there can be very tough days. There can be challenging days. There is challenge within homeless services, not least the fact that we're in this housing crisis and homelessness crisis that never seems to be ending. So I love the use of the word crisis. It's not really a crisis anymore, but then there can be frustration. So supervision is hugely, hugely important. And I think underrated in a lot of services. And I certainly see that when I'm interviewing students to come in on placement. And sometimes when they've come from other organizations or when I'm recruiting, and I talk about supervision and people don't understand what I mean by it. And that makes me really sad and it makes me really angry, because I think we have the opportunity when we have a student who comes in on placement to actually foster something beautiful here and create these social care practitioners that are going to be the future.
We've interviewed quite a few people already this series, and the amount of people who talk about the benefit of supervision and how effective it is to maintain staff's morale, maintain them, keep them even in their workplace, keep their quality of work really high. It just keeps coming up again and again.
Well, since as you brought up students, I take placement students every year, and the last 5 I've had, I would have bet money that they were going to stay working in disabilities. They fell in love with the students. They fell in love with the work. Yeah. 3 of them went to work in homeless services. Totally out of the blue, and they love it.
Wow.
They were fully convinced that they were going to stay working in disability sector, and they absolutely love it. They keep in touch and they said, just can't believe the difference.
Yeah.
Or how much it has in common.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's the transferable stuff, isn't it?
That's exactly it.
And Claire, what would you say the challenges are for people working in homeless services then, apart from the obvious housing situation that we're in at the moment?
I think one of the biggest challenges is that so many of them are Section 39 and Section 10. I think that's one of our biggest issues around recruitment and retention, because it's difficult to attract people when you can't compete with the statutory organisations. Mm. That's one of the biggest ones that we're up against. What I would say is that that's also where it becomes incredibly important how we're going to keep amazing people within the sector. I think it does need to happen, and it is coming, and I know that it is coming with, you know, with the WRC agreement and so on, with the 8% and, you know, an agreement around pay parity and terms and conditions, but it's about time. It's about time. I was at a conference, was it last year, that The Wheel put on, and, you know, their annual summit. And I can't remember her name now. She was on one of the panels, and she just said the standout comment to me for the entire event. She said, I'm absolutely sick and tired of maybe statutory agencies saying, you know, God, you're doing great work. God, you're doing fantastic. You're amazing. And what she actually said was, it's almost like as if it's shit for thanks, because she was kind of saying how, you know, telling me that I'm wonderful and that I'm wonderful, what I'm doing doesn't put bread on the table. Mm. And it doesn't at the end of the day. So if we want to attract amazing people to homeless services, particularly if we want to attract women who are going to go and have babies, who need to be able to access maternity leave, parental leave, and all of these different things and all of these terms and conditions that they should absolutely have, then we need to be able to actually compete with statutory agencies. That's kind of the biggest thing I would say within homeless services at the moment. Like, outside of that, I don't know a more exciting area to be in. Because if I even think of it, like, I'm now running a service and it's the housing side. So I'm involved in buying and acquiring properties, you know, the maintenance team, the housing team, the services team, the support team. That's amazing. Like, I actually still pinch myself and kind of go, how the hell did I get here? You know, it's possible, because there's a lot of growth in this area. You know, it's terrible. We're in a housing crisis and a homeless crisis. But actually, the government are actually putting amazing initiatives and amazing funding in place in order for services to be able to access funding to grow. So like, where Tintawn was a really, really small AHB, we're growing all of the time. And we're growing because actually the government are providing funding to enable us to grow. So that's really exciting. And people who come into that have the ability to be part of that journey and really make a change.
And we haven't mentioned it, but I love the name, the Irishness of it. And
yeah.
Explain what your name is, because I think it's very appropriate.
Yeah, so Tintawn is, yeah, the Irish. Ni Léinn Tintawn or the Hintawn Féin. So there's no fireplace like your own fireplace. There's no home like your own home. It's really applicable. And it's interesting, because we actually did speak on the board, and we have done a few times over the years around, you know, Ireland is so much more multicultural now. Mm-hmm. So we kind of thought, you know, should we be changing the name? Should we, you know, should we look at that? And we decided no, because we thought, no, it actually, the Irishness of it is actually beautiful. And what it represents and what it stands for is so good. Now, people call us lots of things. We're called Tintern and we're called lots of different things, but sure, we don't care.
And Claire, you have a big event coming up next week. Would you like to tell people a little bit about that?
Oh, I'd love to. We're exhausted now with the event coming up next week, but it's going to be amazing. We're so thrilled. So we had this idea about a year ago, because again, the whole area of homelessness is so vast, and the whole area of women's homelessness, because women experience homelessness in a different way to men. A lot of similarities, but there absolutely are differences too. And it's kind of under-researched, really, and underrepresented, but it's gaining a little bit of momentum at the moment. So I remember sitting down after we had one event with the team, debriefing on the team, and I said, lads, I had an idea. And they hate when I say that, because they're like, well, oh my God, what's she thinking now? And I said, I think we should have a conference. I think we should have a conference on women in general, because we are so complex and we're so fabulous. And, you know, why would we not? And at the same time, I was trying to get some research organized and trying to get funding for research on the whole area of mothers who are homeless, who are separated from their children. because this is to me the big pink elephant in the room that we don't talk about. When a woman comes into homeless services, she may have children, and if she's separated from them, she's considered single. She's a single woman in terms of the local authority. And even the whole lack of identity as a mother, you know, it's just so, it's interesting, but in a really sad way. So I got speaking to a development worker from the Southeast Regional Drug and Alcohol Task Force. I'm now a member, but I wasn't at the time. And I was literally ringing him and kind of saying, you know, how can I access funding for this research? And we started talking, and I very quickly realized, wow, he's really thinking the same thing as me. This whole area of women and women accessing services and how they experience services, we've got something here. So we created this small event last September, September 5th in Kilkenny, and we brought together about 70 people from lived and learned experience. We got them all together in the room and we just said, look, tell us, what would you like this event to be? We called it a symposium. And what we learned very quickly was they didn't want a symposium at all. They didn't want what we thought they wanted. They said, we don't want to be lectured to. They said, we actually want to have discussions. We want to have our voices heard. And how we operated that day was cafe style methodology with round tables and kind of just really people brainstorming and coming together. And different themes started to emerge on that day. And one of the themes was the whole area of women's health, hormone health, menopause, perimenopause. We started talking about how in homeless services and addiction services, we don't assess for when a woman has had a period last. And a lot of our women haven't had periods in years. And what, like that's okay? No, it's not. And we know it's not okay, but we're not even assessing that. And then another theme was around the whole area of motherhood and that identity of motherhood, in particular, I suppose, where there can be TUSLA involvement. And this can be one of the reasons why women will access services later. So it's not that we have less women in services. Well, I think we need to look at it differently. We do have less women in homeless services, but I think we need to be asking the question, is it that we have less women accessing homeless services and less women accessing addiction services? And that's a different question. So if they're accessing it later, it's because they're trying to avoid coming into services. Why are they trying to avoid coming into services? And what we heard from women was sometimes when they're trying to access help, they end up getting hurt by what we're trying to do. So our policies and our practice might actually be harming while we're trying to help. None of us come into these professions to want to do any harm, but sometimes we might have gaps and blocks within our own structures, in our own organizations, and maybe we don't like looking at those. So we've taken those themes and we've developed what we're calling Manala Kayla. So it's women together, a change event, because nobody liked the term conference or symposium. So we've decided it's a change event. It's on March 6th and 7th in the SETU arena in Waterford City. And it is going to be incredible. We have Senator Lynn Ruan, who is going to be doing the opening address for us, which I think is fabulous because she's so well known for her passion around equality for women and around the impact of poverty on people. And then what we decided to do, because women don't want to be lectured to and they want to be part of it, is we have panel discussions and we have huge representation with women with lived experience on those panels on the area of mothers accessing services and their experiences within services, their experiences of accessing health services and whether they exist or not, and in the whole area of gendering services. Day two is going to be really active participation, where we take what we've learned out of day one and we start to look at what would we like to see changed and what policies do we want to start looking at seeing can we make change here. So our aim is that this isn't going to end on March 6th and 7th. It's actually going to be part of a change movement.
That's fantastic. And are there any tickets left for this event? Can anybody go to it?
Anybody can go. So if you are a woman, if you love women, if you care about women, any way, shape or form, you are absolutely welcome to come. Tickets are up on Eventbrite and they are free of charge. This is another thing that we wanted, because what we have also heard on our September 5th event is that there are barriers to women accessing different things like this. And one of the barriers is poverty. One of the barriers is not even poverty, but just cost of living. And so we have received funding from numerous places, the task force, the partnerships, the HSE. There's loads of different funding that we've had, different pots from different places. So we're able to do this free of charge, which is huge. So if people search on Eventbrite for help, not hurt, then they'll actually get the tickets now. There's only about 50 tickets left because we've had amazing uptake nationally, which is absolutely huge, from a huge variety of people working in different areas of mental health, homeless services, substance use, TUSLA, the HSE, but also what we love to see is people with lived experience coming because we really want to hear from them.
It sounds amazing. And is this going to be an annual event?
That's our plan. Absolutely. Yes.
Well, Claire, I have to say it's lovely getting some information on new areas in social care that I don't know a whole lot about. Hopefully some people who are listening will find that so interesting that they'll go out and do something in your sector themselves. And for any young students who are trying to figure out what they'd like to do in the future, maybe they might look into your service and contact you for a placement or experience. But listen, thanks very much for joining us. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've loved it.
It's fantastic, Claire. Thank you so much.
Maggie and I hope you got as much from this episode as we did. Wherever you're listening to this, we'd appreciate it if you could hit the follow button. It really helps our reach. Tune in next week as we'll be discussing ageing and intellectual disabilities with Michelle Carter. Take care.